and spread it first through Los Angeles and then through the rest of the country. It also talks about how they were meeting with the leaders of the Contra Army. One of the guys was on TV the other day, Adolfo Calero. We came up with a picture of Adolfo Calero in a kitchen in San Francisco standing next to Norwin Meneses, which incidentally, when I interviewed Meneses, he initially denied that he had anything to do with the Contras, and I pulled out this picture and showed it to him, and he goes, "Okay, you got me." And he was pretty easy. He was pretty easy. We also discovered that, and Danilo Blandone testified to this when he took the stand against Rick Ross in March, that his first introduction to cocaine trafficking came when he went down to Honduras and met with a man named Colonel Enrique Bermudez, who was the military commander of the FDN, handpicked by the CIA, paid by the CIA to run that army. And Enrique Bermudez told him, "You guys need to go to California and raise some money for the FDN, and the ends justify the means." He testified to that in court as a government witness under oath. That's as far as we got on the CIA angle of it. You know, that's all we said, was that these men met with CIA agents while they were dealing cocaine and just before they started dealing cocaine. We also talked about the impact that this Contra drug ring had on the crack crisis in America. And what was amazing to me to find out was that, you know, like a lot of Americans, I believe that the crack epidemic sort of sprung up overnight in 1986 and suddenly it was everywhere. That's what Congress believed when they passed these laws to put people away for years and years and years. Actually, crack had been around for quite a while. And it started in South Central Los Angeles. And as we pointed out in our story, these Nicaraguans created the first mass market for crack in the United States, in South Central Los Angeles, because they hooked up with Freeway Rick. And Freeway Rick, you can say what you want about him, the guy was a genius. He knew how to sell drugs. And he did, you know, amazingly well at it, too well at it. But for years and years and years, Rick Ross had no idea who he was getting his dope from. He knew he was getting it for cheaper than anybody else in town could supply it for him. Believe me, when you're a drug dealer the size of Rick Ross, everybody wants to sell you dope. Everybody wants to sell you dope because you can move it. And Rick didn't need to go to other people to get dope because he was getting the cheapest price anybody could find from these Nicaraguan Contras. And when we went down to Nicaragua, we found out why he was getting it so cheap. Because in the cocaine business, and I had several cocaine dealers tell me this, the biggest cost of the drug is getting it up here. Transportation costs. That's what costs you the most. And their transportation costs were next to nothing. And the reason they were next to nothing, and we found this, and this was in a file in the Supreme Court in Nicaragua, sworn testimony from a government witness again. The drugs were being flown into the United States aboard Salvadoran Air Force planes. We found the man who was the connection to the Salvadoran Air Force, a guy named Marcos Aguado, who Bob has probably run across. He was a Nicaraguan Contra pilot, flew for our day, developed very close relations with the Salvadoran Air Force, and were flying drugs out of Ilopango Air Base. We found a DEA agent, again, you know, hardly a radical, who was investigating drug trafficking at Ilopango Air Force Base in El Salvador, reported that there was drug trafficking going on the military side of this air base in Ilopango, wrote reports to Washington, listed the tail numbers, listed the pilots, listed their criminal records. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. The only thing that happened, he got to say, a guy from Washington came down and said, "You know, you really ought to use the word allegedly when you're talking about these drug flights out of this airbase." And he said, "Well, I'm watching them go out of here with my own eyes. Why do I have to use the word allegedly?" And he never really got an answer to that. Sally Castillo. That's the guy. So at any rate, we did the story. Nobody said anything for a couple of weeks. We did another story after that. We finally got a copy of a search warrant affidavit that was filed in 1986 and disappeared. This was when the L.A. County Sheriff's Office raided this Nicaraguan drug ring in October. Ironically, the same day Reagan authorized the $100 million aid bill to the Contras, they raided Danilo Blandone's drug operation. According to the search warrant affidavit, the L.A. County Sheriff's had information that this drug ring was run by Danilo Blandone. It involved more than 100 Contra sympathizers. They were funneling money to a bank in Florida and buying arms to the Nicaraguan Contras. It was all in a sworn police affidavit in 1986 that nobody ever saw because it disappeared after it was filed. We did that story. We did another story about when they raided this guy Ronald Lister's house, who was one of the money launderers for this drug ring. He was standing there in his bathrobe, and he told the cops, "You're not supposed to be here." And the cops said, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, because I'm working with the CIA, and my friends in Washington are going to be very unhappy about this." This was in a police report that that allegedly disappeared. I mean, when we asked for it, we were told it didn't exist. When Maxine Waters went down to the sheriff's office and refused to leave until they gave her the report, she got it. She got it. And there it was in black and white. There it was in black and white. Since then, there have been a lot of stories about our series that say, "Oh, you know, this isn't true. These guys really weren't Contras after all." There's that picture of Adolfo Calero, but you know, he's such a big celebrity, everybody wants his picture taken with him. Yeah, and then there was this thing in the L.A. Times, which, you know, our series was based, we didn't use any unnamed sources. I mean, we made a rule that we're not using unnamed sources. This is such an important story. It's going to be so scrutinized. We don't want to use unnamed sources. We want documents. We want sworn testimony. We want whatever we can get. L.A. Times goes out with a story quoting an unnamed source that says, "Well, we only think they gave him $50,000. And suddenly that's fact everywhere in the world. You know, if we'd used unnamed sources, I hate to think what they'd have been saying about us. But be that as it may, there have been some congressional hearings started. I'm not so sure about the direction they're going, at least the ones that I've seen on TV. But again, you know, Aiden Pastora, one of the Contra leaders, got up there last week and testified that, yeah, Danilo Blandone gave me $6,000. Yeah, he gave me some pickup trucks. Yeah, I was living in his house. But, you know, the Contras weren't dealing drugs, and they weren't giving us any money, and then yada, yada, yada. So I think this story is really just starting now to come out. The series that we did was just the start of what we're intending to print. We've got a couple more in the works. They'll be in print before the end of the year. And I mean, this is a story that Bob can attest. I mean, this is a historical fact. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is not, you know, some people in a back room thinking about how they can smear Ronald Reagan after all these years. This is a fact. These are historical facts. And that's one of the beauties of doing a story 10 years later, so you've got a paper trail a mile wide. Bob, unfortunately, was doing it while it was going on, which is a very much more difficult story to nail down, because you've got people in the midst of committing criminal acts that really don't want that exposed. So at any rate, I think there's more information coming. You know, people need to get a hold of their congressman and make sure that this one doesn't get shut down like the Kerry Committee investigation got shut down. And maybe it takes 10 years for the truth to come out, but it comes out eventually.
And you'll listen.
Break, you've been on the ship too long. And the train conductor says, "Take a break, drive away, drive away, take a break, and the other says, still ways away." I saw a tree house on the outskirts of the farm. Power lines had blue. Up on the sea.
In front of me. In the Supreme Court of the United States, October term 1988, Greg A. Getty petitioner, William J. Casey, United States of America, Central Intelligence Agency and Department of Justice respondent. Petition for writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Petitioner Greg Getty respectfully prays that a writ of certiorari issued to review the judgment and opinion of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit entered in the above entitled cause on August 3rd, 1988. Number one, opinion below. The Court of Appeals memorandum of decision affirming dismissal, the October 3rd, 88 order denying rehearing, and the district court's order dismissing amended complaint are attached as Appendix A. Number two, jurisdiction. Jurisdiction of this court is invoked pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 1254(1). Number three, constitutional provisions and statutes involved. Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution declares that, quote, no person shall be deprived of liberty without due process of law, unquote. Section 1981 of Title 42 states, all persons shall have the same right to give evidence and to the full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of persons and property, as is enjoyed by white citizens. Section 535B of Title 28 states, any information, allegation, or complaint relating to violation of Title 18 involving government officers and employees shall be expeditiously reported to the Attorney General. Four, statement of the case. In 1984, a plaintiff was first denied his right to give evidence based on racial criteria when Reading FBI agent John Riga refused to accept information of a Section 1116-1117 Title 18 violation by government employees after Agent Riga learned the murder victims he had already known were foreign civilians were Latin American in violation of plaintiff's rights under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, 42 U.S.C. Section 1981 and 28 U.S.C. Section 535B, plaintiff is of partial Hispanic descent. Among the relief which this case seeks is a declaration that the denial of plaintiff's right to due process of the law and the racial discrimination suffered by plaintiff in this specific incident was unlawful. The basis for federal jurisdiction cited in the district court was U.S. Constitution Article 3, Section 2, Article 6, Section 9, 3, the Fifth Amendment, 28 U.S.C. Section 1343, 1346, 1361, 1391B, and or 1391E2, 5 U.S.C. Sections 702, 706, and 42 U.S.C. Section 1981. In 1981, plaintiff first heard the president had put out murder contracts against the government of Nicaragua. Congress responded by prohibiting attempts to overthrow that government. With the Boland Amendment, Congress had made such attempts punishable as homicide in Section 11, 16, 11, 17 of Title 18, and it required the reporting of government Title 18 violations in 28 U.S.C. Section 535B, the Ethics in Government Act. Plaintiff's first contacts with the California and U.S. Department of Justice arose from fear of personal attack and the desire to have law enforcement agencies aware of the organized crime figures he had begun to publish denunciations of in the press. Oh, yeah. So I think it was January 13th, Sacramento Bee had my... In 1983, hundreds of Nicaraguan school teachers and nurses were assassinated by U.S.-backed Contras. If we can sleep while our money pays for this, maybe we're not really waking up. And that was in my exhibits in the affidavit of irreparable injury in the original complaint of in the press. Such attacks have, in fact, materialized. The case of People of California versus Edwards, see attached arrest form, Appendix B, involved an explicit threat against plaintiff's life and the destruction of his photograph equipment as well as assault and battery. Plaintiff was required to make an excess of 6 visits to the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office and request the arresting officer to send the DA's office a second report and complaint after the original was purportedly lost. The assailant was a contract employee of the U.S. military, and this was not the only time an employee of the U.S. military has so attacked and threatened plaintiff for the exercise of his First Amendment rights, and in which evidence of the attack has been lost or destroyed by law enforcement officers. The chilling effect on free speech and the denial of plaintiff's right to due process of the law from obstruction of justice and these other complaints is consistent with that experienced by plaintiff in the present case. Though the president had promised during re-election debates to punish those responsible for producing the CIA assassination manual, his Justice Department, in defense of William Casey in its 826-85 memorandum in Getty versus Casey in the district court below, see Appendix B, defended, quote, the propriety of the plan, unquote, in the Psychological Operations in Guerrilla Warfare manual, named in paragraph 1 of plaintiff's original 1985 complaint against CIA Chief Casey. plaintiff attempted to force the district court to confront the contradiction between the officially expressed policy on civilian assassination of denial and the de facto policy of sanction at the January 10, 1986 hearing on the original complaint. When the district court was asked if it accepted as evidence a government document denying sanction for assassination, which defined the scope of defendant's authority and therefore the scope of federal court jurisdiction, Judge Swart asserted he had never seen the document which was referred to on the civil cover sheet as the basis of jurisdiction. See Amended Complaint Exhibit A, Appendix B. The transcript of this hearing was falsified, deleting plaintiff's objection to the exclusion of evidence of jurisdiction. The district court, in its order on plaintiff's objection to transcript, affirmed that the transcript was in error. See page 2, line 12, 13 of 12-22-86 order, appendix B. In addition to permitting the exclusion of evidence of jurisdiction and the falsified transcript to go unnoted, the Ninth Circuit Court, by refusing to address the alternative cause of action based in taxpayer standing, failed to comply with Federal Rules of Civil Procedure Rule 8E. The pleading is not made insufficient by the because the bottom is all wiped out in the black. The insufficiency of one or more of the alternative statements. The Ninth Circuit Court did not note that defense misstatement at 7-15-88 hearing denying plaintiff's alleged payment of federal taxes in 1986, documented in plaintiff's 4-16-87 response. Plaintiff thereby had a hand in the April 28, 1986 murder of a dear acquaintance of his personal friends, Benjamin Ernest Linder. But
this might make it easier to sell the story. So I went and I met with her, and her boyfriend had a court hearing coming up in San Francisco. And so I met her at the courthouse, and we sat down and talked. And she started giving me documents from her boyfriend's case that he'd gotten under discovery. And some of the documents she gave me pertained to this guy named Oscar Danilo Blandone, who was going to be a witness against her boyfriend. And when Rochelle's lawyer found out that the guy was going to be a witness against him, he filed a motion for discovery. And the government turned over a lot of documents about Danilo Blandone. And one of the things they turned over was a grand jury transcript from 1994 in which he had gone before a San Francisco grand jury and talked about his career as a cocaine dealer. And in this grand jury transcript, which was heavily blacked out, I mean, they didn't turn it over uncensored. They went through with a magic marker and crossed out big parts of it. But he had talked about how he had been dealing cocaine in Los Angeles since the early 1980s, and how he got his start as a cocaine dealer was because the Contras needed some money. And he talked about, getting 2 kilos of cocaine in San Francisco and going to sort of a cocaine dealer school up there in which he was taught how to weigh it and how to recognize good cocaine from bad cocaine. And
now, my friends, okay, L.A., there was a couple cities mentioned. I can't let go by without mentioning Daryl McIntyre was U.S. Attorney. Rob Bonner immediately announces the absence of conspiracy the week after Lawrence Walsh and is appointed as independent counsel. At which point, Dellums dropped his case. That is all he's asking in Dellums versus French Smith. Now, this is all after 83, so Seth Rosenfeld puts down all the data. U.S. Attorney Joseph Russinello gives 37,000 cocaine profits after they're busted off of the Colombian freighter in frogman suits. And, of course, San Francisco was where it wasn't Rob Bonner immediately announcing the absence of the conspiracy. It's the current Intel chief, Di Fi, the Frankenstein mayor, grafted onto the body politic of the best mayor San Francisco ever had. Mm-hmm.
Gary Webb.
And how to hide it in doors of pickup trucks. And I was looking at this document, and I got back to the office, and I called up my editor, and I said, do you remember something long, long time ago about the Contras and cocaine and something like that? And she said, yeah, but, you know, just vaguely, just vaguely.
Hold it, Mary. That's way before the WTC pent bomb. That's the FBI term for what our friends with Blaine Manhattan Eyes refer to as an attack. Anyway, the inside job, obviously. So let me go to the. If it doesn't drop. Oh, it didn't. Thank you, computer. Because today, we have Rosenstein stepping down and. Behind all of these cases, just like behind all the Mueller's and Comey's cases, of course, anything that touches on arming both sides in war crimes, you know, Mueller is saying, oh, they definitely got WMDs in Iraq. And Comey looking the other way for the jihadi, quote-unquote, you know, these are non-Muslims dressed up to murder people in the name of who we are demonizing. The tens of millions of Muslims murdered after the false flag, blaming the victim for our crime while the media, MSM, stooge, zombie stooges, are playing dumb. And what they're playing, what you in the press, or actually in the public even, if you know what's good for you, if you know which side the bread is buttered on and all, and you don't want to rock the boat, then you'll know not to, you know, look into the arming both sides in Iraq that got Olaf Palme and Carl Friedrich Algernon whacked, you know, simultaneously, so that Sweden, you know, host of the dynamite fortune. Never mind, behind all Rosenstein cases is murdered U.S. agent Brian Terry, killed during Clinton gun walking, and David Rayner and Sean Suter. S-E-A-N-S-U-I-T-E-R. A Baltimore police detective was shot dead last week. This is in quotes from a Baltimore paper. A day before he was to testify in a corruption probe involving indicted officers. Now the entire gun trace task force is rolled up, except for, guess what, the guy whose name is in the warrant for, you know, on the confliction database. You got to have, okay, this is the suspect, but the name isn't the suspect. It's the only guy in Baltimore that wasn't kicked off for the, you know, planning, you know, blaming people, other people for our crimes, and then playing dumb. And you got the press playing along with the cops, unless they're like Gary here, that we'll get back to. A Baltimore police detective shot dead last week, day before he was to testify. Authorities say they have no evidence linking Detective Sean Suter's death to the case. Unquote. Exactly like our current intel chief in the Senate immediately said. The suspect is, as if it was the Academy Award, immediate like Rob Bonner announcing the death of Daryl McIntyre as soon as Lawrence Walsh was appointed. Boom, you know, no relation to the case, which happened to be Joseph Russinello, obviously giving, I mean, it's in our paper, mother effing, and he comes back because he's got to frame Barry Bonds, right? Well, behind all that is, he's, you know, how does Dan White get into the building, you know? You got him leaving after shooting in the mayor's office, walking down the hall and whacking the first gay supervisor, so tell me that's not an inside job. And so who's immediately going to announce it's not is never mind. Anyway, that clears SF. You know, you can't have Moscone along with what Gary Webb is describing, you know. And just because, just like Hongisto was going to not let the banks robo-sign and do the fraud, which is fraudulent conveyance, when they know you can't pay. And the small print you never read, there's this, oh, and then all of a sudden there's this balloon payment. We're not telling you about it. Okay, and to the quotes from the Baltimore paper. Oh, yeah, so, okay, nothing here, folks. Move along, said the police. Testimony in the case involving Baltimore Gun Trace Task Force that had the whole gang rolled up, except for the guy whose name was on the non-confliction database. And Rosenstein's subordinate shot the day before his testimony in the Suter side of the case. That would be David Rayner.
in Naco, Sonora, the Mexican military had nabbed a bunch of cartel arms on November 20th, 2009. They include weapons bought 2 weeks earlier by Operation Fast and Furious suspect Uriel Patino, who bought 723 guns during the operation, unquote. So, is it time to duck? Yeah. The Daily Mail, covering the April 8, 2016 order, releasing files on the case. Okay, remember June is when WikiLeaks said, oh, by the way, we've got these the stuff on the theft of the primary, you know, and the fake jihadis, the Salafist Principality death squads, the Operation Arab Sting that the drone bomber State Department under the Mr. Bill's gang, who are the Poppy Bush Coke stand attendants, and of course they're running these bipartisan war machine after the false flag at WTC and Pentagon. Back to April 8, 2016, the court orders the release of files on the Operation Fast and Furious. The years-long law enforcement operation resulted in hundreds of firearms. Well, I mean, it was thousands of firearms, if it was 723 by one guy. This is close. Landing in the hands of Mexican drug cartels, including one that killed U.S. Border Patrol agent named Brian Terry. Under the program, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives directed gun store owners to sell AK-47s, AR-50s, and 50 caliber rifles, among other firearms, to people they knew would walk the guns across the Mexican border illegally. Be brave. I think that was the message somewhere. Oh, it's a horror story, so of course it should be brave. Back to Gary.
Vaguely, and I said, yeah, that's the same way I am. I don't remember much about it, but I remember hearing something about it. I said, but I never remember seeing anything quite this black and white. And I mean, this man's under oath. And he's under oath as a government witness, so why would he make stuff like this up? So she said, well, yeah, it sounds like a pretty good story. So I started, you know, snooping around about it, and I called Bob. And I said, you know, you're the guy that did this cocaine story. And he said, oh, and he told me this long tale of woe that happened when he had taken this story on. And I said, well, you know, I think I'm going to go after this thing. Do you have any suggestions? And he said, well, the interesting thing is, he said, Lawrence Walsh's files, the Iran-Contra special prosecutor, his files have just been turned over to the National Archives. And he said they're going through and they're declassifying stuff. And he says, it's a long shot, but you might want to send a Freedom of Information Act request to the Archives.
Yeah. Yeah. Check it out. Move. If you got the nerve, lash out for your just desserts. It's not just the words. Some of y'all heads up in the cloud. I'ma bring y'all back to earth. It's black back to burn. Bullshit y'all talking about. Out your mouth, I'm not concerned. Cause y'all got to learn. It's y'all turned like Detroit Red. When his head had an ultra perm. The long walk I learned. Your bare heels soaked the worn your boots. The game camouflage like army suits. But I can see it more clear cause I came with the coupe in here. Ring the alarm, inform the troops. Send them out. Go to war on the floor.
The community would be at. To the world is shark infested. They heavy on weaponry like Sharpton Heston, man. Look, it gets low, man. Low, I'm talking about. Get it.
My favorite mutant. to the pigs is my basic statement. I spit street stories till I taste the pavement. Trying to stay out the pen where we face enslavement. Had a foolproof hustle till they traced the payments. I was gripping my palm around some shitty rum, trying to find Psalm number 151 to forget what I'm owed as I clutch the Komodo red. Put down the bottle and come get the gun. Let's get off the chain like Kunta Kinte with a Mac 10. That one was gone like a dollar in a crack den. Steadily subtracting seeds and stems. Mind clouded through the weeds and phlegm. Numbing my brain off of that and the Jesus hymns. If we waiting for the time to fight these is thems. Telling us to relax while they ease it in. We getting greased again. The truth I write is so cold it'll freeze my pen. I boots Riley, it's a pleasure to meet you. Never let they punk ass ever defeat you. They got us on the corner wearing pleather and see-through. All y'all's gold mines, they wanna deplete you. I ain't just finna rap on the track, I'm finna clap on the back. And it's been stacking it at 500 years before Iceberg ever leaned back in the lack. Before they told Rosa Black in the back. Before the CIA told Ricky Ross to put crack in the sack.
Archivist and see if he's got anything on these guys. So I sent off a Freedom Information Act request, fully expecting to hear nothing back. And I got a call from the archivist who said, hey, we found some stuff. We can release you about 36 pages. And I said, great, send it to me. And so he sent me these FBI reports from 1986, which talked about this this fellow named Ronald Lister, who I had never heard of in my life, and Danilo Blandone. And what these reports said was that these guys were involved in drug trafficking, they were raising money for the Contras, and that at some point in time, because this part was blacked out, I couldn't really tell what they were talking about, Danilo Blandone's lawyer had called the L.A. County Sheriff's Department after his client had been raided and said, the CIA winked at this sort of thing. And then I called my editor up and I said, I think I got some confirmation for what this guy had told the grand jury. I mean, here's the 1986 FBI report that says he was dealing drugs for the Contras. 1994, he's saying the same thing for the grand jury. He's probably telling the truth. So at that point, we decided we needed to find Danilo Blandone. And Rafael's girlfriend, turns out, she knew a lot more than she let on.
Hustling's in my blood. My father's name is written. His history consisted of robbery, killing, and pimping. Filthy rich and the biggest killer that you ever seen. Once I'm older, I'm taking over. I'ma be king. I was locked up in jail when he got the new land. Opened his cells, I guess that's how the story began. First mission was to clear it out and claim it as mine. Indigenous people was peaceful, it took no time. Great grandmother Africa was blind and disabled. Sons was traitors, we played divide and conquer, invaded. Sold the children into slavery and profited quick. Started making side deals and that's how I got rich. Daddy Britton found out and tried to put me in check. He don't understand I'm a man and I deserve some respect. Try to bring it to me but I play for keeps and I won. Feel my daddy but you ain't the only man with a gun. More money, more problems, little brother is wild. They call him the South, he country with a big ass mouth. Try to show him new business but he don't wanna change. Love him but I knew eventually I'd blow out his brains. I'm American.
With this sort of enclave of Nicaraguan cocaine dealers in San Francisco. And she knew a lot of them, and they were personal friends, and they were personal friends of Rafael's, and she sort of guided me through this underworld and let me talk to some people after assuring them that I wasn't a cop and I wasn't going to arrest them or anything. And they started telling me about a guy named Norwin Meneses, who, it turns out, in our story, was the sort of the primo cocaine dealer for this Nicaraguan drug ring. He was a Somocista. His family, his brothers were generals in Somoza's army. One of his brothers was the ambassador to Guatemala. He was very well connected, and he was also a major cocaine trafficker in San Francisco. And from that point, well, we started putting together the story about these two Nicaraguan cocaine dealers and how they were working for the Contras. And I went down to San Diego and did some looking through some court records down there, and I came up with the case that got Danilo Blandone arrested and made him a government informant. And started calling the lawyers of the co-defendants because I wanted to try to find Blandone. I didn't know where he was. And I was going down the list, and nobody'd seen him. And I called one of the attorneys. She said, oh, you know, he's going to be in San Diego in a couple of weeks. And I said, oh, yeah, how's that? And she said, well, have you ever heard of a guy named Freeway Rick Ross? And I said, well, I had, because I had done this story on asset forfeitures, and one of the cases I looked at when I was doing this series was Rick Ross's case, because he never had anything forfeited to the government. The biggest crack deal in L.A. got to keep all his property. So I knew who Rick Ross was. And I said, well, what does Rick Ross have to do with these Nicaraguans? And she said, well, they were his suppliers. And I said, wait a minute. The Contras were supplying Rick Ross with crack, with cocaine. She said, that's the information I have.
I said, you know, go for it. Sounds great.
And so we spent the next six...
That the Occupy movement, and especially as it reached Oprah, because, you know, Oprah now has a reputation of being the most radical and progressive Occupy movement across the country. Maybe you don't know that, but people I talk to in New York and Georgia and other places absolutely respect what Occupy Oprah has done. And the blood that you've already shed, what you have, you know. And I think that the importance of the Occupy movement cannot be lost, and we can't allow ourselves to fall back because of whatever is going on, and we don't have the kind of movement that we want. Now, I want to just say, just quickly, you know, when Dr. King, just before he was killed, talked about the question of where do we go from here, and that's the question I think we're facing right now. And one of the things that King said is that in order for us to know where we go from here, we have to talk about where we are now. And in that time, he spoke about black people, and I want to mention this because I wanted to show you the connections that are going on today. As I mentioned to many people, what the whole purpose of Dr. King, the activity that he was geared toward at the time of his assassination was the Poor People's Campaign, if you remember. And the Poor People's Campaign was to occupy, literally, the area around the White House and all throughout D.C., set up Tent City, which they did do, and say that we're not going until we get what's ours. Now, that was a powerful statement. Now, in addressing that question, Dr. King said, where do we go from here? Well, we look and we see black people. We see that we, despite the Civil Rights Act and all the legislation, we have half of what is good and double of what is bad. And that the White House and the government is going to have to change that condition. And so what we're going to Washington, D.C., at the time he said in 1968, 67, and then 68, what is ours is we want guaranteed income. We don't have jobs, so we want a guaranteed income. And we know the government can provide it because the government is spending all the money in the world on war that has nothing to do with us. And we want that defense budget shifted so we can all, if we can't get a job, we want guaranteed income. But what we ultimately want, Dr. King said, and people don't remember this, we want a total redistribution of the wealth of this nation. If you remember, when he started talking about redistribution of wealth, Dr. King was mowed down like a dog in Memphis, Tennessee. And if anybody thinks James Earl Ray was the assassin, then I got some other stories to tell you about this government. Now, I say that to say because at the same time, the Black Panther Party was talking about the liberation of black people. But what we recognize is that while we had a subjective goal in our own interest, that our goal could not be achieved and we were not on moral or ethical ground if we talked about the liberation of black people in the context of the oppression of the native people. So we said we can't be free as long as the native people are oppressed. So we said we have to formed a coalition with American Indian Movement, AIM. Leonard Peltier, Free Leonard Peltier Today. So how are we going to talk about the freedom of black people in the context of the oppression of the Latinos that are working the farms of California like the slaves in Georgia? We said we can't be free, so we helped to form the coalition with the Brown Berets. And what about the Puerto Ricans and others working the fields and the industrial fields of New York and living in poverty? We said we can't talk in Chicago, so we helped to form the coalition with the Young Lords organization. And what about the Chinese and the Asians? We formed a coalition with the Red Guard. And what about half the world, women? We said, how can we talk about black liberation in the context of the oppression of women? And so we said that women's liberation was a part of our agenda. And what about gays? We were the only black organization, matter of fact, the only progressive organization that saw the question of gay liberation as a part of the revolutionary struggle that we were engaged in. We said, what about the people who are disabled? And we formed a coalition with the Center for Independent Living. And what about the messed up environment in this country and how we're all subject to the horrors of that environment? So we formed a coalition with the Center for with the truck for public land and created a program of gardens in the ghetto? And what about our brothers and sisters that were in Vietnam fighting against the American, the same oppressor that we had? We didn't call for peace in Vietnam. We called for victory for the Viet Cong. We said, what about our brothers and sisters that were fighting against the same imperial empire in South Africa? We said, we formed a coalition with the PAC. And we said, what about in Zimbabwe? We formed a coalition with ZANU. And what about in Mozambique? We formed a coalition with Frelimo. Now, I say all that to say that one of the things that the Occupy movement has inspired me is that it has reached beyond the question of one group versus another. We don't have any conflict. We know who the common enemy is. And that enemy you have identified in language that everyone around the world now identifies with, and that's the 1%.
Yeah.
We understand one thing, that the rest of us are the 99%. So the question is, what are we going to do and where do we go from here? And I want to remind you of something that made you who you are and us who we are as I joined in and gave my lent my voice to what you already started in Oakland. Glad to walk the clothes down the port of Oakland. Tell me they lost $4 to $8 million that day. I'm like, oh, you had $8 million? That's it, I'll be 70 in March. I walked like I was 12 years old walking around there to close that damn force. And I want to tell you, the bottom line is this. You guys are leaders. You can bring other people into this, but the way we're going to do that is you're going to have to take some actions again. That doesn't mean we get killed. It doesn't mean we get beat up. We have to find some better actions and some more strategic actions. But the bottom line is that's who you have become. You've got your, the world is recognized. The world is recognized Occupy Oakland specifically. So be proud.
Global.
Let's join together. Let's keep this going. And let's remember, the power belongs to the people. All power to the people.
DJ, but in case you didn't know, Spain has issued a warrant for Bibi Netanyahu. We'll play something.
My home is in Louisville, Mississippi. It's located in the black belt of Mississippi known as the Delta area.
Casey Neal at Tristan's
event.
This is a song about things coming full circle and a lot of things like that happening. Here we go. The song's called Ouroboros stuff that.
Oh, the streets of this town lead to the next town, all the way around the world, through all the oceans in endless motion, diving for pearls, and the water keeps moving high up in the air, and it falls on our head and runs through your hair. And the places we are now, the places we've been, are one in the same now. We end where we begin. And you, my companion, my long-lost friend, again I am with you. We begin where we end. Every direction leads us back again to the doors of the houses we used to live in. Bed is still warm, oh, where we once lay. Pillow still holds the shape of your face. Places we've been are all in the same now. We end where we begin. And you, my companion, my long lost friend, again I am with you. We begin where we end. Thank you.
Again, I'm with you. Begin where we